want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. This is our final installment for the year. And I wanted to take a look back at the rocky nature of race relations in the United States in 2015. Despite the fact we've been presided over by the first African-American president, the surfacing of the Black Lives Matter movement, the continuing problems with African-Americans and law enforcement show that we have not turned the corner, and we are not post-racial. Today, you're going to hear two brilliant people who know a lot more about race and racial issues than I do. David Theo Goldberg, who was born in South Africa, is the professor from UC Irvine, whose latest book is Are We All Post-Racial Yet? And it raises a lot of powerful questions. Also joining us for the dialogue is Linda Martine Alcoff. She is Panamanian and Irish-American, with a lot of poor white relatives in the southern United States. And these two atypical perspectives, I think, provide some great insight into the issues that we're dealing with, from Trump to Black Lives Matter, to Justice Scalia's comments about African-American academic skills, and much more. And before we get going, I want to thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the PBC podcast. People like Aaron Blair, Linda Gray, Jeff Lipinski, Deborah Kennedy, and Faith Peoples. I'm grateful to you individuals, and I want to invite people who never hear their names mentioned here to get on board. Go to peterbcollins.com, and you click on the menu button in the upper right corner. From there, you click on Become a Subscriber. You can choose $5, $10, $20 a month or $50 annual. We've got an iPhone, iPad app that's available for under $3 in the Apple Store. And we've just announced a relationship with Spreaker. Spreaker.com and the Spreaker app, S-P-R-E-A-K-E-R. And very soon, you'll be hearing the Peter B. Collins podcast via Spreaker. Take that, you Android users. So thanks for listening. Thank you for your support. And here comes my conversation with Professors Goldberg and Alcoff. Today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, a discussion about race in America in 2015.
To everyday life.
Sisters! Niggas! Niggas! Niggas!
Oh yeah, don't forget the crackers.
Don't worry. Don't worry. If there's hell below, we're all gonna go.
The message I took from this song by Curtis Mayfield is that if there's an afterlife, it won't matter what race we were during life on the planet. If you've never heard the song, check it out. It's quite a tune and has a very powerful message. Joining me today are two distinguished professors who have written recent books about race. And I think they share some common views, but their books are quite different. Linda Martine Alcoff is a professor at the City University of New York Graduate Center and Hunter College. She is a former president of the American Philosophical Association, and her new book is a very interesting meditation. It's called The Future of Whiteness. Linda Martine Alcoff, great to have you with us today.
Thanks so much, Peter.
And also joining us from the University of California at Irvine, where he's a professor of comparative literature, is David Theo Goldberg. He was born and raised in South Africa. He's got more degrees than I'll ever have, law and economics from the University of Cape Town. Then he picked up a PhD at CUNY. And then he started producing film and music videos, which is a fascinating addition to his resume. And David Theo Goldberg's new book is called Are We All Post-Racial Yet? Professor, thanks for being with us.
Cheers. Happy to be here.
It's good to talk with each of you. And I think that these issues are extremely important. And every time we have an incident that involves race in this country, there's discussion about how we need to have a national conversation. And I feel like that conversation never really takes place, that we end up with sound bites and talking points and people talking past one another. So in a few minutes, I want to ask each of you to comment on important events that have occurred over this past year, the protest at Princeton and the outing of Woodrow Wilson's legacy, including some deep racism that many of us were not aware of, the police killings, and the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement in this country, the long overdue removal of the Confederate flag from the Capitol in South Carolina. Justice Scalia made some recent racist remarks that I'd like you to touch on. And then there is the Donald Trump, the rise of Trump this year, which includes significant elements of racism. But before we dive into that, I'd like to spend a few minutes with each of you here to talk about your books and your points of view, and help our listeners understand where you're coming from as we discuss these contemporary issues. So, Linda Martine Alcoff, I'll start with you. Your book, The Future of Whiteness, is a fascinating look. And when we talk about racism in the United States, whiteness is the factor that's never discussed. We don't talk about what you call vanguardism. So give us a sense of how whiteness fits into a discussion of racial disparity and racial conflict in the U.S. today.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. It's sort of the hidden default that organizes the discussion on these other topics. So we have to find a way to talk about whiteness. And I think people are, you know, hesitant and afraid and don't quite know how to talk about whiteness because it looks like it's just going to lead to, you know, the idea that all white people are racist and, you know, won't lead to a productive conversation. So I was trying in the book to offer a way to be able to bring whiteness up to the level of discussion instead of it sort of lurking in the background of so many of our discussions, as it often is. You know, my friend Christina Beltran, who's a commentator on MSNBC, just got in trouble the last couple of days for talking about the white reaction that is a part of the Trump supporters. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, Breitbart is going after her. She's getting death threats. I mean, just to use the term white reaction elicits this kind of response. So we have to find a way to be able to talk about what whiteness is in all of its complexity and, you know, as a kind of organic phenomena. That's what I'm arguing, is that it's not reducible to the U.S. government's policies to provide advantages for European American immigrants over others. That's been a central feature of what white identity has been in the United States, but that's not the only thing that is true about whiteness. So I think, you know, we need to be neither naive about what whiteness is and its history, but we also don't have any reason, I think, to be fatalistic about its future.
Mm-hmm. In your book, in the introduction, you write, "Whiteness is not simply an identity that emerged from racism and the repression of other groups. The actual complex historical experience of those marked as white is tremendously varied, and many have known few real privileges." And this is really important because, you know, Donald Trump reflects the white elites, but there are many long-suffering Americans who are white and poor and undereducated, underrepresented, and their aspirations are rarely, you know, brought into the discussion. And so there's a whole range. You know, Curtis Mayfield mentioned the crackers. And in the southern part of the United States, we have a lot of names, some of them kind of rude and crude, for different types of white Americans. And yet on television, in particular, we celebrate affluent whites, suburban whites, the perception, I think, that's generated is that that represents the broad cross-section of white Americans.
Yes, you know, the largest number and real numbers of poor people in the United States are white. White mortality rates are going up. White unemployment is high. And I think the only political leaders who are really trying to speak to this constituency directly as whites are the real right wingers, the right wing of the Republican Party, the white nationalists and nativists and so forth. Liberals really don't think that they can appeal to white workers or the white poor in a non-racist or anti-racist way, and leftists don't either. So nobody is speaking to that very large constituency of the United States except the white right. And I think that's partly why they are drawn to people like Trump, because they think that their interests will be spoken to by those folks. Of course, I don't think that's the case. I mean, I think, you know, most white people in the United States today come from families who were economic migrants in the similar way to Guatemalans and Mexicans today. Economic migration, fleeing, in some cases, political, religious persecution, but mostly it was looking for the ability to make a livelihood. That's what drove Europeans to come to the United States. And so that's a big part of people's identity, the lore of their family, their experience, the way they understand themselves in this country. They don't understand themselves as colonizers or settlers who came here for racism. They understand themselves as just, people looking to be able to economically survive. And we have to, it's true that that's a big part of people's identity and people's experience. I'm half cracker myself, you might say, and talk about it in the book. I'm half my family's poor Irish. My grandparents were sharecroppers. My mother lived in a railroad car for a while. And the other half of my family is Latino. Mm-hmm. So I'm sort of a borderline white, I think. But, I think when you visit the flea markets in the rural South, the concept of white privilege just doesn't, come to mind very easily, because people are really struggling. But that doesn't mean that even my poor white family didn't have pretty significant advantages. They were able to homestead and get land from the United States government. They were able to vote. They were able to own guns and shoot the meat that they ate without fear of getting shot, by their neighbors of another race. I mean, they had significant advantages over African Americans in the South, even though they were at the lowest end of the white economic, ladder.
Mm-hmm. And I want to say that to both of you that I have a pretty good vocabulary, but you expanded it as I read your books. Linda, explain the term eliminativist to our listeners, please, and how you use it in the book, and who is an eliminativist?
Yeah, it's a hard word to say, isn't it? It's a piece of jargon. You know, we all have our own jargon and our own feels, and it's the term that's used to talk about people who either want to eliminate the concept of race entirely, or more specifically, they want to eliminate the identity of whiteness. So there's a movement of abolishing the white race, not meaning physically, but through the concept of whiteness, that people should no longer believe that they are white or think that they are white or identify themselves as white. And I'm arguing against that trend. It's pretty powerful among, certain sectors of the white anti-racist activists and academics, but I'm arguing that it's completely unrealistic because whiteness is a part of what has made people what they are, their family background, their history, the way they interact today, and that material advantage, even though it's slight in some cases, is going to continue to exist for a number of generations, even after this country becomes majority non-white, mm-hmm. because most white people's wealth is in their real estate, and the value of their real estate is determined by how many white people live in their neighborhood. And with that real estate, people take out loans so their kids can go to college, and they, you know, can really have the kind of class mobility that other groups can't have. So that material advantage is going to continue for some generations. So I think whiteness is going to continue to have a kind of meaningfulness as a part of our identity. It's not the only part of our identity, but it's going to have a certain meaningfulness materially and psychologically for many generations to come.
And Linda, so in your book, you go into the history of the terms Caucasian and Aryan and establish that they're really not a good marker or a good label for what you are describing. And you also just touched on the issue of class. And what you're describing in whiteness is more than ethnicity. It's more than the constructs of race that are applied to, you know, various groups of people, depending on where they came from and how they are treated in various caste systems. But you use the term whiteness to describe more than just what we call race.
Yes, I think the terms Aryan and Caucasian are not analogous to whiteness because they were totally based on bogus histories, mm-hmm. and, you know, bogus sort of racist claims. Whereas I think whiteness was actually used by a lot of people to describe themselves because it was quite useful given the ethnic mix, you know, when people started marrying people of other European nationalities and ethnicities, and through long distance and many generations, they lost linguistic connection with those European identities. So whiteness really filled the gap to explain what people were. And American, you know, American should always include multiple groups, ethnicities, and races. So you can't equate American with whiteness either. So I think whiteness has been used because although it has been associated with certain bogus vanguardist, you know, hierarchies of race, it still fills a gap of explaining, you know, people's identity formation that occurred once they came to the United States after immigration.
David Theo Goldberg, Linda Martine Alcoff quotes you several times in her book. And before we started recording, she told me that she really values the frame that you have provided. You've this is, I believe, your sixth book that you've written solo, and you've edited many as well. And in Are We All Post-Racial Yet? It's quite a quite a ride, I have to say, because it is a sweep of your consciousness, and it is quite a powerful dump, if I may say. You really roll around this question of what is post-racial and are we really there? Give us your thumbnail of what the term is meant to mean by the people who most commonly use it, and the various definitions and permutations, implications that you write about in your book.
Yes, thanks. Much appreciated. So I begin from the question, which you could pose as a kind of question requiring an empirical answer or a yes-no answer. Are we all post-racial yet? Are we beyond race? Does race apply in our society in ways that are deleterious or problematic for certain population groups, most notably black and brown folk in America, among other places in the world? And obviously, when you pose the question in that way, a question that really became popular or a claim that became popular increasingly after Obama first got elected, we've elected a black man, a man of mixed background, to the highest office in the land. Clearly, we're over the historical concerns. But when you pose the question and you look at the data, I mean, the obvious answer is no, of course not. I mean, blacks continue to suffer conditions of a negative social variety of ways, whether it's incarceration, prison, whether it's unemployment, whether it's lifespans, and so on and so forth. I mean, whatever social index one draws on, one can say that blacks are significantly worse off than certainly whites and pretty much everybody else in the society by significant margins. So, any straightforward understanding of the question is that, of course, we're not post-racial in that sense. My argument in the book, fast forward to my answer to the question that is the title of the book, is that indeed we are post-racial, but really for all the wrong reasons. We're post-racial precisely because the post-racial represents today not the end of racism, not the moment we've reached beyond racism in a kind of idealized or romanticized sort of way, but it actually represents the new modality in terms of which race works in the society, a set of social logics that hide some of the historical drawbacks on the basis of which people have suffered by being characterized in racial terms. And so it makes it much more difficult to get at the social conditions of racism. I think two things in listening to the earlier discussion with Linda. The interests of whites by politicians today, by, as she put it, white nativists and so on, the interests of whites are largely spoken to today by stoking race, yeah, not by getting beyond it, mm-hmm, on the one hand. And the other, taking off from the most recent Republican debate this past Tuesday, there was a lot of appeal to political correctness, right? And I want to suggest that appeal to political correctness is actually one of the principal things going on there, is a coded appeal to race in the following sort of way.
Indeed, yes.
It is no longer in this language that racism is the problem. It's the charge of racism that has become the problem, for people like Donald Trump and Ben Carson and Ted Cruz and so on and so forth, right? So there's a kind of reversibility. It's not the historical populations that have suffered racism that continue to suffer it. It's now whites themselves, right, who are being charged wrongfully in this characterization with racism, and it can be waved away or dismissed by political correctness. That points to a deeper undercurrent of how racism as a social logic in terms of the notion of the post-racial is working. What do I mean by this? I mean that it's now more and more, the principal claim is that racism structurally is no longer a problem. That's the principal argument.
Right.
Where there is racism, it's a function of bad apple individuals, whether it's in the police force, whether it's in universities or in school systems, you know, doing racist acts or making racist claims. And the rest of us can, or the rest of society, the rest of whites can say, oh, that's not us. It's these bad apples.
Mm-hmm.
They're anomalies. They're exceptions to the rule. You know, we're all clean as a consequence. You know, there are no longer discriminatory laws. There are no longer discriminatory institutions. Quite the, you know, if there is discrimination, it's in terms of affirmative action. We should all be treated according to the same set of rules, the same set of admission processes, the same set of regulations. So when that is done, it covers over the long historical legacy and contemporary implications of that legacy for those who have suffered racism. And it makes it more impossible to address that legacy. I mean, those conditions where people suffer, people are suffering decreased lifespans, those who are black in contrast with whites. Black unemployment rate is double that of the white unemployment rate. Black wealth is one-tenth of white wealth for reasons that Linda pointed to, largely having to do with the legacy of real estate ownership and so on.
And the risk of being of a black man being killed by a police officer is at least three times higher than exactly. that of a comparable white man.
Right, and the incarceration rate is significantly higher, mm-hmm. And so on. So one can... add all of these social characterizations to point out that the conditions for blacks and, I should add, brown people in the United States, for Muslims today increasingly, is significantly more difficult and challenging than it is for whites. Getting a loan to buy a house, getting a loan to buy a car, the cost of cars, the cost of housing. Actually, when you disaggregate for all other considerations, is considerably higher for people of color than it is for white folk.
And let me quote a few lines here from your book,
sure.
Because you answer the question in the title of your book, "Are We Post-Racial Yet?" in many different ways, and it's really fascinating how you attack the question from different angles. At one point, you write, "Deception operates as a logic of tactical calculability in the face of uncertainty. It isn't that post-raciality reshuffles the structural deck. Rather, it deceptively enlarges and deepens the modes of articulation, expression, rationalization, and explanation of its extended racialities. It doubles down on their impacts and refusals while seeking to obscure from view their racial significance and extension. In the final analysis, the post-racial is a mode of social magic, the alchemy of racism into non-racialism, into deracination. It sacralizes the negation in the name of desacralizing anti-racist struggle. It etherealizes racisms in the spirit of its overcoming. The ghosts of racism's past are dissolved into the indiscernible pixels, making them up." And when I read this passage, David, I thought of Chief Justice John Roberts, who wrote the majority opinion striking down the most active section of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And he basically argued, look, we elected a black man. We don't need this anymore. Mm-hmm. And within hours of that Supreme Court decision, well, let me not exaggerate. It took them a few days. Mm-hmm. The state of Texas rolled back its voting regulations and access to the polls in response to this, because they no longer had to pre-clear those kinds of moves with the Justice Department. And we've seen this happen in states all across the country with these phony requirement of a photo ID for somebody to vote. They claim they're wiping out a problem that doesn't exist, voter fraud. And I argue that it covers up for a real problem that does exist, which is election fraud. And and I think that that is the same model as claiming that we're post-racial as a way of avoiding the real race problems that we continue to grapple with.
Yeah, that's a very, very good example of what I'm getting at. It makes it much more difficult to identify the racism precisely because the very terms by which to identify it, race itself, right? If we're no longer able to use race or any of the categories that are historically associated with the notion of race, it makes it much more difficult to identify racism where it occurs. There's a similar kind of example one can offer. For example, it was a failed attempt, but a very revealing one in its failure. In 2004, I think it was, the state of California, Ward Connolly, who was a regent of the university I serve in now, introduced a measure for the ballot called the Racial Privacy Act.
Mm-hmm.
And the Racial Privacy Act would have made it illegal for public institutions to use race for any purposes whatsoever, but for two exceptions. The two exceptions themselves are revealing. One was for medical research for racially characterized diseases like mm-hmm. Tay-Sachs disease and so on. But the other one, of course, is racial profiling in relation to criminal justice activities. So one could use race to identify criminals and so on. But for any purposes such as collecting data on discrimination in the housing market or in the employment statistics and so on, it would have been impossible to use. And so happily it failed, but you see there the way in which race works in a post-racial system. It would no longer be possible for public institutions, government and so on, to use race in order even to keep statistics about racial discrimination. The title of the act was revealing, the Racial Privacy Act. So mm-hmm. it would make it okay for private individuals to discriminate. I could advertise, as long as I'm not using state resources, I could advertise an apartment that says for whites only. And not only would it be okay for me to do that, the state is actually protecting my private expression, right? My freedom of speech in order to be able to do as such. So there you see the way in which race is erased from the public sphere, from government activity, but protected exactly by the government when it's used in a proliferating kind of way in the private sphere. And that drives exactly how post-raciality is operating in extending modes of racial inheritance on the one hand and disinheritance on the other, how it privileges some or continues to privilege some over time while disprivileging others. And the Scalia remarks that you referred to earlier about affirmative action operates in exactly that kind of way.
Yes. And David, another angle that you pursue in the book, among many, is you write, the politics of post-raciality demands such a culture of militarization, which serves to extend racial identification and alienation as the explicit terms of racial reference are disappeared, eliminated without exterminating, and any racial significance can be denied when charged. I would also add to this the whole frame of professional sports, and that, you know, we see these many of the real high-performing, high-paid stars are African-American, some Latinos, particularly in baseball. And this is used as a substitute or maybe just a distraction from the lack of success, the lack of opportunity for the millions of fans of these stars of color.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it operates in exactly that sort of way. I mean, the way in which, you know, as with an African-American president, so with, you know, a small wedge of African-American stars in sports can be referred to in order then to say to the rest of the society, look, I mean, these guys are earning, you know, that they occupy the highest offices in the land, they're earning the highest salaries in professional sports.
They came straight out of Compton?
They come straight out of Compton, exactly right. They have great recording contracts, even if it took them a lot of hustling in order to get that. If we could take Straight Out of Compton as our reference point,
yeah.
You know, they you know, as with Curtis Mayfield and other recording stars, you know, along the way, I mean, James Brown and so on, they get ripped off royally, in certain ways. But they can be pointed to as examples of having made it, and therefore we no longer need quote-unquote special privileges in order to license the possibility of some being brought or the, you know, the larger group of disprivileged Black and brown people being brought into the capacity to have possibilities in our society over time, right? So it makes it very difficult, even to, you know, when the critical language that one can use to identify racism, one sees it most definitively in the Black Lives Matter movement now. Right, which is an attempt to bring back into focus the language of race in order to characterize these disablements, these disabilities that are promoted socially across the board. It makes it very, very difficult to get at without being able to draw on the language of race and its legacies historically, which continue to disable people being able to get ahead as a result of these legacies of racism historically.
Well, I want to turn now to a discussion of the issues that I raised at the outset, but I want to recommend each of your books to my listeners, The Future of Whiteness by Linda Martine Alcoff and Are We All Post-Racial Yet by David Theo Goldberg. They're both from the same publisher, Polity, and they're out in inexpensive softcover editions right now. And David, I don't think we'll delve into this later, but I just want to thank you because you make repeated references to the disparate relationship between Israel and the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And that's an important issue for me, and I really appreciate that you include that in your discussion of these matters. So, Linda, let me turn to you because in your book, you spend a chapter talking about Washington and Lee University and the legacy of the Confederate general and slave owner Robert E. Lee, who served as a president of that institution. And more recently, it's interesting because when we were emailing the three of us to schedule this interview, I mentioned that I wanted to talk about Princeton and the protests there over the legacy of Woodrow Wilson, who was a president of the United States and also a president of Princeton University. And the three of us all said, you know, this came as a surprise. I had never studied the full history of Woodrow Wilson. I remember him as the guy who was promoting the League of Nations and seemed to, you know, be a pretty decent middle-of-the-road American politician. So talk a little bit about some of the legacies of racism that are enshrined at American universities. And, you know, should we purge Woody Wilson from Princeton?
Right. I think, you know, it's kind of like a cultural revolution that's happening right now in the United States as we look at the flags and the public sculptures and the names of buildings and streets and rethink sort of this backdrop of our society that has just, you know, been taken as sort of the normal backdrop. Of course, you have Confederate soldiers honored on state grounds throughout the South. You know, and I didn't know this whole history about Woodrow Wilson enacting segregation in the public spaces and the government, when he was right when he was at the same time developing the institution of the League of Nations. And I think some people might say, well, you know, yes, he was racist, now we know, but don't besmirch the whole man, because he did try to institute a moment of international cooperation in the midst of World War One, and but I think the point is that once we find out that he didn't really believe in racial equality, then it causes us to rethink and re-understand what he was doing with the League of Nations. I mean, could he really believe in global dialogue if he had this view about Black people not being capable, you know, not being intellectually equal to white people?
Well, so, and from what I've learned just in the last few weeks, Wilson's presidential campaign was based on a Southern strategy with a whole lot of support from the Klan.
Yes, the Klan was huge at that point in our history. So I think it's not just that he had a good side and he had a bad side. We have to re-understand the so-called good side in light of understanding more about what he was about and what he was really aiming for. And, you know, we have to face the truth. I mean, we can't continue to live in this la-la land, which just wants to deny, you know, the actual facts of the history of the United States and the history of our leaders. Washington and Lee was a fascinating place to visit because it's one of the most prestigious colleges in the South. It's named for George Washington and Robert E. Lee, and they, you know, it's where Robert E. Lee is buried. His whole family is buried, and he's basically lying in state in the chapel where all of the meetings are held. You know, the graduation events. I mean, it's just astounding, and they have this, little place where you can go and buy memorabilia about Robert E. Lee, and there's just nothing in there about slavery. He's portrayed as, and I grew up going to public schools in the South, and I remember this very well. I mean, Robert E. Lee was a hero. General Sherman was the bad guy, and Lee was portrayed, as he still is today in Washington and Lee University, as a man of honor.
Yeah, he was the Confederate statesman.
Yeah, he had integrity, you know, that he was asked to lead the Union Army, but he said no, he had a responsibility to the South because he was from there. So he did it on the basis of a kind of honor rather than a commitment to perpetuate slavery. And there's just no evidence for thinking that his notion of integrity extended to equal relations, you know, among people. So I feel like all of this kind of material background and public culture that we live with every day, we live amongst every day, our children are growing up in every day, contributes to the kind of racist ideas that leads to killings by police and incarceration, you know, rates for Black and brown people that are way higher than for white people. I mean, this stuff is not trivial. It's not just culture. It's part of how people get ideas about what parts of our history are important and what our history actually is.
So should we be sanitizing that history? And in particular, should Princeton shut down the Woodrow Wilson School of Policy? I can't remember the exact title. And there's also, I guess, a dormitory or some sort of a quad that is named after him there. If the students do prevail in their demands, there'll be a whole backlash from the anti-political correctness crowd. So, Linda, first, what is your recommendation? Should Wilson's legacy remain at Princeton?
Well, Wilson's name is all over lots of places. It's not just Princeton. And, yes, I think we have to face the truth. I wouldn't use the word sanitize. I know you're using it because that's the kind of term that they use, but it's not about sanitizing. It's about telling the truth and facing up to history. And that history, you know, it's always complicated. There's, you know, even good guys had bad elements and bad guys had good elements. But let's look it in the face and then see whether people would really feel comfortable going, you know, to a school named for Woodrow Wilson, putting Woodrow Wilson's imprimatur on a Democratic institution, and so forth. I mean, I don't think it makes any sense, but I think the point is that the truth needs to be faced and not sort of hidden away, and then we can see, you know, how does it really feel to have this on your diploma, right? Mm-hmm. to have this kind of stuff in our public culture. I think I was in the South Carolina state grounds not too long ago, and they have a statue of a Confederate general. What they did in response to protests in the past, before the new movement started, was they had a sort of both and strategy. They put up an artwork that was a kind of bas relief of civil rights history, mm-hmm. that was within stone's throw of the Confederate general. So they didn't take down the Confederate general, but they did put up this other sort of African-American history, mm-hmm. public artwork. And I think that's just not adequate, you know? Mm-hmm.
All right, let me get David's take. David, yes. Theo Goldberg, please.
Yeah, it's very interesting. A number of things. I think the first thing to point out, as Linda was at least implicitly hinting at, is that when you have the principal representatives of the society, those who have a very public visibility about them, as with Woodrow Wilson or Lee and so on in these public spaces, who both articulated themselves and represent these incredibly deep racist histories, in a society that always has been, but today especially, is extraordinarily heterogeneous and diverse. What it says to those who are not white is that you don't belong, or you don't fully belong, or you don't have the same kind of standing in the society or at this institution that those who are white do have. And so that translates into issues of confidence, issues of being and belonging in a place, issues of feeling like the institution belongs to them or doesn't belong to them, and so on. And that reproduces through the networks that that it then licenses, transgenerational transference of privilege and wealth and well-being in the society in ways that continue to reproduce racism. So I'm absolutely with Linda that there has to be a much, much more robust engagement with these sets of questions that students at the like of Princeton and Missouri and other places are opening up. And then, of course, Black Lives Matter in a different context are pointing to as well, both to contextualize the history, but also to ask questions about the contemporary legacy, not just to make it an historical question. And quite frankly, the paragons of political correctness be damned.
Very well put. Now, in terms of Black Lives Matter, this is a huge set of issues and incidents, but I really commend particularly the young and often female activists who are speaking up. They've used some tactics like being rude to Bernie Sanders in Seattle that I didn't particularly cotton to. But that moment of rudeness pales in comparison to the daily experiences of many non-whites in the United States. And the whole issue related to policing, the exploitation of these communities of color, by extracting fines and imprisoning people who can't pay those fines, which then criminalizes poverty or low incomes in bizarre ways. There are a lot of thorny issues here. But fundamentally, Even though we have integrated our police departments, the way that they operate with the code of silence, where officers who witness their colleagues committing crimes not only remain silent, but they write reports that attempt to cover these incidents up. And the most recent video released in Chicago is, I think, a sharp example of that. And my fear is that this movement, which I think is very important and raises very significant issues, is going to get lost in the shuffle of the presidential campaign and in the louder and you know, openly racist commentary that's coming from Donald Trump and in more coded ways from some of his contemporaries running for the Republican presidential nomination. So I'd like to ask each of you to just give me a quick sense of how you see the Black Lives Matter movement going forward and what non-blacks can do to support it. Linda, let me start with you.
Well, I think the elections are always a great educational moment. Beyond what the candidates themselves do, it creates an opportunity to assess where we are and where we're going. I'm a big Sanders fan, but I tell you what that moment did when the Black Lives Matter folks interrupted his speech. Mm-hmm. It had a good effect.
Yeah.
He is coming from Vermont, not as clued in to these issues as he should have been, and he got a leader of Black Lives Matter on board of his campaign. He sat down, did some thinking and studying and understanding, and he came out with a very, very strong set of proposals. So it informed his understanding of what, he needs to do. He just did a kind of a brilliant barbershop interview with Killer Mike, who's a rap artist in Atlanta, that was just brilliant.
I've seen it online, but I haven't watched it yet. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it can be good for the Black Lives Matter movement will get eclipsed by the election. I think the election will be an avenue for them to raise the issues and force agenda changes. The question is whether people's changing agendas, like Hillary Clinton, who's trying now to change her agenda, whether that is really credible or plausible given her own track record around welfare rights, and whether or not people will be held to account for the claims that they're making during the election season when whoever gets elected gets elected.
Well, and in 2008, she openly pandered to white voters in the South in ways that made me cringe. And her husband, of course, got involved in some of the primaries with some pretty dubious messages. David, what are your thoughts about the future of Black Lives Matter?
Yeah, two things. I mean, first, I think they have done an extraordinarily important job in surfacing the structural racism, most notably in relation to the criminal justice system, mm-hmm. For those who weren't paying attention to it, right? So the way in which Black people are being profiled and stopped on the street. I mean, under Michael Bloomberg, there was something like 765,000 people a year stopped in New York City, and I think it was 2011 or 2012. Mm-hmm. Which, if you do the calculations, is something like, every minute and a half of every hour of every day in New York City at that time, a person, 90% of whom are people of color, were being stopped for no reason whatsoever by the police, mm-hmm. right? And the number of arrests were really, really, really small. So they've done a terrific job, obviously, unfortunately, helped along by the series of brutalizing cases on the part of police and murderous cases on the part of police, particularly in relation to black people in the streets. Mm-hmm. So that has been an incredibly important service that they provided. The second point I think to make is that there have been an exemplary revelation in terms of how you build a social movement. In a sense, I mean, it's been wondrous to watch. almost. And I think the key moment, actually, while obviously the Bernie Sanders campaign event was important, the key moment was when Hillary Clinton kind of wagged her finger at them and said, "You have to give me policy considerations to take back to the kind of halls of policymaking because that's how I operate." And to their incredible credit, within 2 weeks, they had started Campaign Zero. And if listeners haven't looked at the Campaign Zero website, I urge them to do that. Beautifully crafted, clear-minded as can be, 10 points to pursue, including, you know, Campaign Zero, obviously referring to no more police killings, a radical reduction in incarceration of people of color in the United States, and just a range of considerations feeding into the terrible effects of the criminalizing, the racially criminalizing system in America. So I think they're not going away. Linda's absolutely right that they're here to stay. I think considerably after the next year and the presidential campaign, and I look to them to draw on the considerable energies of young people, in particular in America, to keep the finger on the button and not let America at large and politicians in particular, not least politicians in the Republican presidential campaign, as well as Sanders and Clinton, off the hook on these incredibly important issues.
Well, and in addition to targeting politicians, I think we need significant correctives to the media. Mm-hmm. Because one of the problems is that unless people riot and destroy property, the media won't cover peaceful protests in most cases, or they downplay them and marginalize them in many ways. And we need to take seriously the comments and protests that people have and really air them out instead of just looking for the next incident that they can use to put on TV and try to hype the ratings. Because the media, I think, does have a very negative role in these issues. I want to turn next to the remarkable comments from Justice Scalia during the oral arguments of the University of Texas affirmative action case. And he noted that one of the briefs in the case pointed out that most of the black scientists in this country, he characterized it this way, don't come from schools like the University of Texas. They come from lesser schools where they do not feel that they're being pushed ahead in classes that are too fast for them. Now, this patronizing, infantilizing set of comments from a Supreme Court justice, to me, are quite outrageous. And there was a wave of reaction to them. But I think people should be calling for him to resign or retire, and failing that, be impeached. David Theo Goldberg, what was your reaction to his comments?
Thanks for pushing this. For one, as others have pointed out, he's empirically wrong on both sides of the issue over here. He's wrong just in terms of the data at least in the implication that blacks are not smart enough or well-trained enough to get into the best institutions. But he's also wrong that when they do get into the best institutions, it's not that they fare worse. They actually, the data points out, a recent, actually, I think this week, earlier this week or late last week, the data from Georgetown, a survey, shows that they actually graduate at higher rates when they get into elite institutions, precisely because they feel challenged and are working harder. The other thing to point out, of course, is also that elite institutions are not simply about training. I mean, the 1948 case, Sweet v. Painter, which is about the University of Texas Law School establishing a separate law school for black students at the time, which was ruled unconstitutional, pointed out, was that it establishes lifelong networks.
Mm-hmm.
So one finds people, enabling networks over lifetimes to access jobs, to access the capacity to make investments, to be involved in business ventures. I mean, all kinds of things. And when you disable people from having access to those networks, that has transgenerational consequences. So it's incredibly important that we maintain robust heterogeneity and diversity at least commensurate with demographic heterogeneity in these privileged and elite institutions. And Scalia, I think, he is up there. It's time for him to move on. I'm not a great fan of lifelong appointments to anything, least of all the Supreme Court. And I do think it would be great to see a constitutional amendment that made it possible to have, 10-year appointments, maybe with another 5-year or so extension. But it pays to have diversity on the court too, quite frankly, mm-hmm. Both in terms of age and in terms of gender and in terms of race and ethnicity.
Linda, what is your comment on Justice Scalia's remarks?
As a professor at the City University of New York, which is, I'm sure, not one of the institutions that he thinks is highly ranked, I really took issue with, his idea about sort of the ranking and the, pyramid of higher institutions. And I think that what the implicit assumption is that many people hold is that if an institution is seen as less prestigious and has more people of color in it, then, it's a place where we're not pushing our students. We're not challenging them as much as at other institutions will be. We're doing sort of remedial work. And that's just not the case. I mean, at CUNY we have, it's a majority-minority, even though we have 480,000 students that we teach in the city of New York. And we push very hard. So I think it sort of lends itself to a certain racialization of the pyramid scheme in higher education, portraying community colleges, lesser resourced public institutions as places that are less good in terms of the education that we're providing to our students. And that's what creates the sort of the loop, the domino effect, so that students coming out with a degree from these other institutions, they're not taken as seriously. So the people's work isn't judged on its own merits. I mean, I think connected to this, in regard to your earlier point about the media, it's sad that the videotapes of these police beatings and killings has been necessary to galvanize a larger sphere of the public behind making reforms in criminal justice. It's sad that people had to see for themselves the videos because they didn't believe what they were being, told by black and brown people about the nature of interactions with the police. And I hope that now that people have seen the videos, it can cause them to rethink how they were assessing the credibility, the veracity, the reliability of people who are saying, no, this is happening in our communities. The police are an occupation force. They're not protecting us. And so rethink sort of the way in which we judge other people, people of color in particular, in terms of their intellectual capacity as well as their honesty.
Mm-hmm. Next, the Trump problem. Pardon me. when he surfaced over the summer, with his intention to run for president. It just seemed like a publicity stunt. And he launched with his virulent attacks on immigrants by mischaracterizing the problem as, you know, primarily at our southern border, and then compounding that with his racist remarks about Mexicans. And each time we think we've seen the lowest point, he shows us that he can go even lower. So he called for banning entry to the country for all Muslims worldwide. And then during the debate in Las Vegas this past week, he expanded that to say that he would kill the family members of jihadis, including women and children. And this is so beyond the pale, and yet it really did not produce much new outrage. It's just, oh, there goes the Donald again. And it has really connected with a lot of people who agree with his sentiments, who have deep racist feelings, some of which are masked by post-racial covers. And so this is a virulent phenomenon that continues to grow. And the predictions by the hopeful thoughts by many people that, oh, you know, he's going to come and go, he'll get bored and move on to something else, haven't proven to be the case. And I think he's doing a lot of damage to our nation. Linda Martine Alcoff, how do you respond to the Trump phenomenon?
Well, it's painful as a Latina to hear what he was saying about Mexicans and building borders. But, you know, I think that, you know, his mass base, his support level has not gone down when he makes these statements. So I think we have to think about what that's about. And I think his white support has to do with a feeling of uncertainty as the demographic changes in the United States are about to occur by 2042, so that white people will be below 50% of people in the United States, and an uncertainty on the global stage where the U.S. is no longer such a dominant economic power. Even though we have the most nuclear weapons, we can't make our way, we can't have our way wherever we want in the world as easily as we have in the past. And so people are really feeling the, you know, an uncertainty about what our place will be as a nation and what white's place will be within the United States nation, what the future is going to bring. And I think that uncertainty is real. I think the feeling of threat is does have a basis. I don't think it's like the hysteria the Germans whipped up around in the 1920s and 30s to blame Jews, who were 2-3% of the population. They were not a threat to anybody in Germany. So that was really whipping up a hysteria. Today what we have is a real change globally and nationally, and we need to have some leadership that can speak to that change and can speak to white people in a way that can chart a future in which we can all, you know, have a part to play without it being a ranking system or a zero-sum game in which we win and everybody else loses.
Mm-hmm. David Theo Goldberg, your comment on Trump.
Yes, I agree with all of that. I'd add a couple of things. I mean, the first thing to point out is of course, that wealth inequality is increasing dramatically, so that a smaller and smaller body of people is holding a larger and larger proportion of the resources and wealth of this country, and having undue effect on the political system. And it's largely white, and is appealing to, as Linda pointed out, an increasingly anxious and fearful white constituency, and really flaming that up, not least within the context of you know, the dramatic global unsettlement that we're going through contemporarily at the moment. So there's clearly all that at play. I would add another context, which both is and is not sort of racially driven, in the case of Trump himself. I published a piece earlier this week in Slate on this very issue, on Trump himself, characterizing him as the quote-unquote perfect president for our moment in the following kind of way. He represents the proliferating what I call make-believe in our society, that one can make pretty much anything up and just make a claim about it. And if one is persuasive
bombastic.
I was going to say exactly that, bombastic performative enough, you'll get lots and lots of people to believe it. And Trump is the perfect representation of that, right? I mean, you could almost call it trumpeting, right? In a way to... and the make-believe is double-edged. It's both a kind of fantasizing or fabrication of claims on the one hand, but there's also a kind of compulsiveness, a compellingness, compelling people and making people believe what you want. And Trump has that personality of forcing belief on people, of dismissing people who disagree with him sort of out of hand in outrageous ways.
Well, and he had a practiced line that he used in the Las Vegas debate where this is not about religion, this is about security.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And so here he was trying to divert any attention from the obvious racist implications and just the ludicrousness of the idea in general,
right,
to appeal to the insecurities. And both of you have commented on the insecurity that white Americans feel. And it's not only because of the demographic shifts and the economic shifts, but it is also because of the largely exaggerated threat of terrorism and these things that are stoked by the media and by political figures. And they really have psychologically identified a way to manipulate large numbers of Americans based on their own internal insecurities. Would you agree?
Yeah, that speaks to an added consideration that I think is very important that we've not touched on at all. And that is that, to put it in a pithy kind of way, racism anywhere, in this case in the United States, is shown up by racism most everywhere else, right? And racism everywhere else is exacerbated by the conditions locally. So there's a kind of global and increasingly global context in which these things are playing out. And the fact that the global world has become more unsettled, the fact that Paris has happened twice in the last year, the fact that there have been these events in other parts of the world in various ways, the fact that America is bombing the hell out of Syria and Afghanistan and the Pakistan border and Iraq and so on, and has been for some time now, is part of this broader context in which these ideas then can take hold and both exacerbate and speak to the anxieties and fears that people have, rather than a much more measured understanding of what's taking place. That said, on the other side, one can say that the university activities on the part of students pointing out the racial structures and context of universities or racial criminalization system has resonances and are shored up in important and interesting ways, in activities in places like South Africa, where the decolonizing the university movement has taken off, as well as in places like Europe and so on. I was just in Paris, actually, until yesterday, running a workshop exactly around this set of issues. And it's interesting that a discussion about religion, which was the focus of the group that we had in place with local Parisians, quickly became a conversation around racial considerations.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, I'm going to have to leave it here. I would love to continue our conversation, and I think that we have touched on a lot of very important issues. I want to thank Linda Martine Alcoff, the author of The Future of Whiteness, and David Theo Goldberg, his new book, Are We All Post-Racial Yet? Thank you both, and happy holidays.
You too. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
I hope this conversation about race gives you some things to think about. You can email me your feedback, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until